So now we want to engage the panel as a whole, and maybe there's a couple of things I would want to put out there that kind of strike me when I see all of these talks together, and it in some ways it seems that one of the things that we're trying to resolve, part of the work I do is based on concepts that come from the field of artificial life. And one of the things that provokes the development of that field is that when we're trying to develop a general theory about life, we really only have this one model. And so we can't quite do some of the comparative methodologies that we've maybe historically done in other fields. And so in each of the works that you all are doing, I see these kind of innovative ways to try to ask kind of profound questions where we may not have the ability to do some of the A-B testing that we have been able to do in other ways. So we develop things like new computational systems to do modeling and simulation, look at the ways in which we might have a kind of innovative way to think about our own kind of humanity's past. So maybe the question back to you is it seems like that one of the key things for doing this is coming up with really very different ways of configuring even the position from which your question is asked from. So the importance of multidisciplinarity to your activities. And so with that, how would you start to see with where you're at now, with where you're posing the questions, maybe I'll direct this first back to Ralph. If we understand where we're at right now, what might be the very next set of things that you might characterize that we might expect to come from this kind of approach to understanding the human brain?
Well, it kind of depends how long it takes to make some technical advances.
So maybe you could dig into that a little bit.
Yeah, that will be the first step. The first step is some real advances in ability to do things that we don't currently have, but which we see possible paths towards doing. If they were clear-cut, they would have been done already. So therefore, it requires exploration, it requires trial and error. These are things that you can't set a timeline on. And initially, what they will do is probably give us a greater ability to detect events at the very small scale in the brain, but then the next step beyond that is figuring out how to assemble those into large ensembles. And that may be the biggest leap in this process. To the extent that one can get through that problem, or even make incremental improvements in it to see a bit more, then it really starts to become possible to ask broader questions about large-scale interactions in the brain. And large-scale interactions have been only possible to explore in relatively crude ways so far, by techniques that are slow in time or poor in spatial resolution. And any improvement in that gets you down to the time frame in which we actually do the very quick things that we do. Think of how long it takes you to recognize a face when somebody walks in the room. As far as we're concerned, it's instantaneous. We'd love to be able to see what that looks like. Can't see it right now. And in a situation like that where you could do it somewhat reproducibly, you might even be able to do research on it. For things that have to do with imagination and creativity, which are one-off events, that's going to be a little hard to recognize from all of what's going on. So you have to be extremely clever to figure out how to address a problem like that. But these are problems that one can at least begin to be able to puzzle over how to address once we get to this technical capability.
And Aish and I have just finished putting a grant together around this to try to come up with a method that, you know, may start to give us a glimpse about something around what the phenomena of imagination and creativity is from what we can know today. And a big part of it is this way to, you know, look at tools such as what we're hearing about from SDSC, of what we can do with large-scale computational methodologies that, you know, we just didn't have 5 years ago, and how the kinds of data that we can gather and can gather in methods that involve many, many users can start to maybe help us pull some of the signals out of the haystacks that are quite of interest to us. And now with this, in a way, it starts to, this kind of framing of what it is to be human is really a fundamental question here. And both Pascal and Aisha's work, you know, starts to, you know, get us to really radically rethink the notion of the human-centric. And there's other kind of people who talk about, you know, the post-Anthropocene era that we may start to be moving into as our notions about the nature of the human start to become more complex. And it starts to become more complex even as a means of trying to actually understand what that essential nature of the human is. So I don't know if at CARTA this is any of the work that you guys, you get out on those kind of limbs at all.
Well, I briefly hinted at the novel findings based on fossil DNA, which, you know, until quite recently it was, you know, many paleontologists just discarded. Neanderthal went extinct. Others are in love with them, know they're the same species. We now know that there have been at least three instances of hybridization between things that diverged from million plus years. What does it mean if you have three lineages of ancestors? What does it mean if you're mostly this one lineage of Homo out of Africa that then bumped into Asian things? You don't have one ancestral lineage, you're a web of humanoid forms. So that would very much force you to rethink this kind of linear notion of the ape that stood up and then started writing. But maybe if I may quickly address the idea, what the methodology, one of the hallmarks of imagination are metaphors. And one thing we observe in these discussions is that we have very different disciplines, like the hard sciences with the genome sequencing, and the linguists and the field primatologists. But as they talk to each other, they hear about genome organization, about non-coding DNA and microRNAs, but they think about syntax and semantics and language and say, wait, that reminds me of things I deal with. Maybe there is something like a syntax at the genomic level. And I think that's where some advances will come in, because we're limited. We have one life, one human species. You can't rerun the experiment. You can explore novel ways of enriching the landscape with robots, for example, but you can't rerun the experiment.
Absolutely. Yeah, did you want to?
I'll just jump on the interdisciplinarity aspect. Here at UCSD, I did my PhD in the cognitive science department where I now work, so I was sort of brought up in this interdisciplinary tradition, and when I left UCSD is when I realized people thought I was weird to be thinking about robots when I studied, you know, visual perception and, you know, cognitive neuroscience. And I think it's just sort of been a few years for the world to catch up with the way that we were thinking already at UCSD. So we really kind of need to keep that alive at our university and sort of be thinking about where everybody else is going to be 10 years down the line. And one of the things that you've said, that you've also alluded to, I actually didn't get into this to try to be like, oh, let's, you know, make AI. I had already given up on that because I was decided I'm going to study the brain. But I wanted to see, well, what would the brain response look like if the brain encountered something that didn't evolve, that didn't exist until we as humans made it. It's not a biologically emergent evolution, but, you know, it has evolved nevertheless, these weird androids that we have. Or you can have, you know, an impossible body movement, or you can have an impossible eye movement. And it's sort of like if you look at really simple visual illusions where you have an impossible shape, but our brains deal with it nevertheless. And then trying to figure out how our brains fall into that illusion, we find out something about the brain. So that's the space that I, as a cognitive scientist, are actually am more fascinated with than possibly making, you know, robot friends. But again, there are people who are interested in that goal, and there are people who are interested in understanding the human brain, and sort of together we can do something that wasn't possible before.
Yeah, and you know, and one of the things that draws me to all this is this interest in being able to better understand human experience. And one of the more fundamental things about human experience that we are dealing with here is learning. And so, you know, we talk about undergraduate education, et cetera, and we've started to talk about this a bit amongst some of the work that we're all involved in. But just the way in which all of these might really radically change the way we approach learning and how individuals can respond more effectively to dynamic content environment. So I think I'm being pushed off the stage now. So.
Excellent. Let's thank this panel and our moderator for a wonderful set of presentations. Thank you.